You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi there. Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you break free from body shame, binging, and diets that don't work. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. And so does my guest today. Her name is Naomi Joseph. She is the author of the new memoir, Binge and Sprint. And she has a question for you. You will understand Naomi from this question that she has for you guys. Have you ever stood at a kitchen counter urgently devouring insane amounts of frozen stale hot dog buns dipped alternately in jelly and almond butter while on high alert for approaching humans? Right? Who can't relate to that? Naomi Joseph is the author of Binge and Sprint. It is a memoir of her life struggling with binge eating disorder. She tells the story of fighting the secret taboo war with humor and authenticity. And her story is incredibly relatable and, I must say, incredibly funny. Who knew that binge eating could be so hilarious? Welcome, Naomi. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor for me to be on with you, Dr. Nina. Thank you.
So you are welcome. I'm glad you're here too. So tell us what led you to write this book.
So interesting question. First of all, it was in the beginning, it was difficult for me to really be so vulnerable and put my journey out there, because I do think that binge eating disorder has a stigma of being very shameful. And people live in a closet behind closed doors in quiet desperation, too embarrassed to reach out and get the help that they need. As we all know, when you do binge eat, we do it in private, we do it in secret. And because there is this stigma attached, and I know certainly in my community, it really leads to difficulties in marriage and then difficulties with infertility. And I just, once I really realized what this was all about, I knew that if I could tell my story and help at least one person not go through what I went through for as long as I went through it, then it would all be worth it for me. And what I found since I've written the book and sort of gone public with this is that so many people are beginning to come out of the closet and get the help that they need and that they deserve and start to understand why they do this and have begun to free themselves from it. And I think that that is the purpose, because when you're going through it and you're by yourself, you kind of feel like a freak of nature, right? And that nobody else is going through the same thing as you and you're so all alone. But once you say, oh my gosh, that person and that person, you mean it's not so abnormal and I don't have to be ashamed and I could reach out and not be embarrassed. And that's what it's about. It's everybody telling their stories and touching each other to give the people the confidence to know that they are worth getting the help that they need so that they don't have to suffer any longer.
Yes, and to realize that it's actually not about food, right? That yes. Food is the solution to the problem. It is not the problem. And I think the way that you come to realize this in the book, and by the way, if anyone wants to join us, I forgot to say, if anyone has a question for Naomi or would like to join us or has a comment, a question, anything, the number is 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815. We'd love to hear from you. The way that you come to realize, oh, something's going on here that's not like other people, and how you went from shame to understanding is really a beautiful part of the book. But tell us, how did you first begin to realize, Oh, wait. What I'm doing with food is different from what other people are doing.
So I think the first time, because I always thought this is just how everybody does it. I didn't know that what I was doing was different than what other people were doing. It to me, it was just like private eating, and I thought that everybody was like me. And it was the first time I realized that I did something different. I was in college, actually, and I was with my sorority sisters, and we were having an event, and we were all, it was like a big sleepover with, just like in the movies, all the sorority girls, and there was a big sleepover with somebody. And I had made a comment, because, when all girls get together, there's all this junk food and all of that. And I had made a comment. I don't remember exactly what I said, but it was something about how, oh, we can all eat together in private and, publicly together and not hide in private. I said something like that. And I remember the girl looked at me like I had three heads, and she had no clue what I was talking about. And all of a sudden, like a ton of bricks, it hit me. I was like, oh, you mean everybody doesn't do this? And all of a sudden, I was like, that's pretty different. Like, that's a little, why do I do this and why don't other people do this? And I didn't know that before.
And I also appreciate, as someone who comes from a Jewish heritage, how you weave in how the cultural parts of Judaism and pushing, sort of pushing food on you all the time. And it's not only the Jewish heritage that does that, but my grandmother used to say things like, you can stand to lose 5 pounds. Would you like some pound cake? Things like that.
And it's the guilt. It's the guilt. The Italians aren't too far away from us either. There's a lot of cultures. I think people really show their love through food. They really do. And if you're not accepting it, then it's offensive, and it's insulting to people. And so it's that whole cultural part of it. I know I'm a Sabbath observer, and Sabbath food is supposed to be special. Doesn't mean have to be calorically like a caloric bomb, but that's certainly in practice, what we do, and so it's sort of hard, difficult to escape that.
It was, the way that you richly wove in your experience culturally in the tapestry of the book was great because it was poignant, it was funny. I mean, what I love about this book is that it is so powerful and it is so poignant and it is so funny. That we have to be able to find the humor in life and to be able to like kind of support ourselves and take ourselves seriously, but also lighten our spirits too.
I think the world, I think if we could just laugh at ourselves a little bit and find the humor in everything, because isn't there humor in everything? And I mean everything. And I think it's when we can do that, even through something that is so painful, then we can sort of remove ourselves a little bit and take a broader overview, and then we can approach it a little bit differently, see it from a different perspective, and that always assists us in moving forward.
If you were to go back, I love Back to the Future. We know Back to the Future and Star Wars, two of my favorite movies. So if you had the DeLorean time machine and could go back in time and talk to yourself at a time when you were at your most you know, egregiously low in the most awful place with food, with yourself, with your body, with whatever was going on, what would you say to yourself if you could go back?
So I think at different stages in my life, I would have said different things. I think in the beginning, I think it was, you know, when I was very, very young, as a youngster, when you develop these habits of binge eating, of trying to comfort yourself, I look back and I really applaud that little 8-year-old me, the little 10-year-old me, trying to nourish myself. It was really, even though it wasn't, you know, maybe the best idea, I think it was very beautiful how that little girl was trying to parent herself and say, you are beautiful, you're okay. You know, here, sweetheart, have a cookie. It'll make you feel better. That was all I had. And I think that that's a really, you know, you look back and you say, oh, I started binge eating. But if you can find the beauty in that, of how you were trying to parent yourself and tell yourself that you're okay. Here, you deserve this. Have a cookie, sweetheart. You know, you're doing the best that you can to try and parent yourself and make yourself feel better. So I do think that there was beauty in that and there was love in that. It wasn't all bad.
You know, it's such a compassionate way to look at it. And binging, you know, with binging, food is a frenemy. It is a friend in that it does something for you. If you don't have another way to cope, it does it. It fills an empty space. It gives you comfort. It does a lot of different things. It helps you. But of course, it also ultimately hurts you and kills your spirit and makes you feel terrible. But I think that the attitude that you would have about, hey, sweetheart, have a cookie, because that's the only way that you knew to offer yourself comfort. That kind of compassion is such a vital ingredient when it comes to, oh my gosh, I just unconsciously used a food reference, a vital ingredient. It's such a vital part of cultivating compassion. We're compassionate to ourselves. We make ourselves feel better, not worse. When we're friends to ourselves, we use words to make ourselves feel better. We don't say to our friends, oh, you feel bad, here, have some cake. We say, oh, you feel bad, let's talk about it.
Yes, for sure. And yes, you are correct in that. What it really does is you're trying to pull yourself together while making yourself fall apart all at the same time. So it is that frenemy. And to answer your question, as an adult, because of course what we do is we take those coping mechanisms and they just become habit, and then we needlessly drag them with us into our adult lives where clearly it no longer serves us. And I think that if I could go back, I would do a few things. First of all, I would explain to myself that I am worthy, because that's really what all this is. It's really about finding your worth, finding what you deserve, that you don't need to schlep around in a body that doesn't fit you, and that you deserve to give yourself the healthiest, most beautiful foods that help your body be the healthiest and feel the best that it could feel, because that's really what life is about, and it is what you deserve. We are all a child of God, and I was the daughter of a king, and I deserved to have the things that would make my body function the best. I would tell myself that my surroundings and the chaos that was going on around me was not my choices. I didn't create that, and that I didn't have to listen to the negative messages coming my way, and that they weren't true. I think when we are little, we take in all of these messages that we're receiving. As kids, we are amazing observers, but we're really not so fabulous at interpreting the messages that come to us because of our, you know, limited development. We're only children, but we take that and we wear that as like the Scarlet A, and then we go through life like that. And I think the adult me would just tell myself that none of it's true. This burden is not mine to carry, and that I deserve just the healthiest things to make myself the best me. And I didn't need to punish myself with this burden of food.
Beautifully put. And once again, for those of you who are showing up later, I am talking with Naomi Joseph, author of Binge and Sprint. Here's the book. So, Naomi, tell us about the title.
Oh, so, okay. Binge and Sprint. I love the title of this book because this, to me, represents my whole journey. So there's two parts to it. First, you binge. And binging to me was using cake as fortitude. So you sort of get all of your energy or all of your, you steal yourself with cookies and you like gear yourself up and you, but really, what are you doing? You are just filling a void. You are deadening yourself to the feelings that you're having. You are stuffing down what is really bothering you. And then once you have shape, then you can sprint. You can go on to do whatever it is that you need to do. And usually I would run myself into the ground because everything that I did was I used it as a platform to prove my worth, which was really why I was binging. So it's sort of that round thing. So I'm sure people here can relate to what I'm saying, where you use that food to, you think that you're using it to just, okay, get it down so you can run and do everything you need to do. But what you're really doing is stuffing and numbing. And then you run and do all these things that you don't want to do. And a lot of times what I'm finding speaking to people is that, like me, binge eaters are real overachievers. And they are overachievers because, again, using everything as a springboard to prove your worth. And then it just, you need more fortitude because you're so uncomfortable doing what you want to, what you are doing, that you need to come back to the binging to deaden yourself. And then you sprint out again. And then it just becomes this vicious cycle.
Yeah. I find in 20 years of treating eating disorders that people who struggle with binge eating are often very good at taking care of other people. They're all about the needs and wants of other people, and they give everything to other people and take care of other people, and then food takes care of them. And that was definitely the case really for you, taking care of other people and not really able to take care of yourself.
Everyone else comes first.
I hope that's now past tense, right? Everyone else came first. And now hopefully you got that oxygen mask on you, because if you give your oxygen away, we know what happens. What was the turning point for you to say, enough, I have to do something different?
So this was in recent years. I mean, I was in the very, very deep in the binge eating for over 40 years. And what had happened was that my mom had passed away, and I have two other sisters that one lives very far away. Another one is whatever, there's a whole situation, but I was really kind of the only show in town. And I was taking care of my dad. And we had had a tumultuous relationship. And he's, you know, very much in the European mindset. And we, it just became quite a lot with a full-time job with another business as well, and running myself into the ground. And I remember waking up one morning and he had been in the hospital, and I was running and I was having very, very little sleep, and I was trying to keep myself in that mode I had been in my whole life of everybody else comes first and I don't matter. And so I was sprinting, and then I needed to get that binge in to deaden myself so that I could continue with that sprint, because that's how I had set up my life. Mm-hmm. And my life wouldn't work if I wasn't doing the sprinting. So I was doing the binging more and more. And I woke up one morning, and I'm a tiny person. To carry weight for me, and I have a very small frame, and it's difficult. Like I can't function, and it doesn't take a lot to make me larger than my frame could carry. And I woke up one morning and I was having difficulty breathing, and I was binge eating. It makes you tired. It interrupts your sleep. It interrupts how you function during the day, how you carry yourself during the day. It's physically quite taxing. And I woke up one morning and I sat in bed, and I was just in the middle of all this. And I remember thinking two things. I remember specifically thinking to myself, if I continue like this, I am going to die. My body cannot carry this anymore. I'd really give myself some terrible disease, or I could, I don't want to say, what, but like, I can't physically continue to function like this. And then the second thing I thought was, I don't want to feel like this anymore. Mm-hmm. And I made a decision that day. And I remember I said to my husband later that day, I said, I am going to change my schedule, if it's okay with you, with the kids. And I'm going to wake up early every morning, and I want to do the 6 a.m. class at the gym before I go to work. And he said, sure, no problem. He said, what is like the time frame? How long are you going to be doing this for? And I said, I'm going to be doing this for ever. And he said, okay. And I did. And I started doing that. And after a couple of months, making small changes with food. So I was doing the exercise, I was doing that part of it, but I was still binging. And then after a while with the exercise, it just started making my mindset a little bit healthier. And then I wasn't saying, okay, now I'm going to go on a diet, and now I'm going to have my way and measure my food and do, it wasn't like that. I was giving myself grace. I started to make very small changes, a little bit at a time. And then when I was ready, I started making small changes with food, and a little bit more all the time, a little bit more every day. And that was a very defining moment for me. And I knew that I couldn't calm myself. Somebody had suggested, maybe you can take medication to calm your nerves. If I don't change, I'm going to be larger than my body could carry. I am going to develop some disease. I'm going to be on medication. No, something has to change, and I have to change. And so first it started with exercise, then it went to food, then it went to the underneath, the relationships, the mindset. And then I reversed the cycle of binge and sprint to reversing it in healthful food, healthful, joyous movement, healthful relationships, healthful mindset, healthful self-care. And so I started, instead of this way with the binge and sprint, I started reversing it and going this way one thing at a time.
And you also did a beautiful job of talking about the underneath, which always comes from the past, to be able to show how your past impacted your relationship with yourself and other people, but doing so in a way of explaining rather than blaming. So a lot of people don't want to look at their past because they don't want to blame other people. And of course, that doesn't help. But there's no good that can come from going, it's their fault. Wow. You know, like, no. But to say, okay, this is what happened. This is how it affected me. And this is the thing that I need to heal so that I can move forward, so I can change, is really powerful. And, you know, when you just mentioned the underneath, it made me think about, I'm not going to give too much away because I want people to read the book, but how understanding the way that the messages that you got and the way that you were treated, like you mentioned your dad in sort of the old school ways, which could mean a number of things to different people, but how that affected you, how people's personalities and what they were doing affected you, and how that in turn affected your relationship with food, how exploring that and healing that was also very freeing.
So I want to just comment on what you said about blame. I really did. Could we all point a finger and blame our family members? Oh God, that would just be so easy. And warranted could be. But number one, I didn't want to put any blame in the book or any blame in this conversation, because that just leaves us powerless. The point of the book and the point of this conversation is to invite people to lean into their power and lean into their greatness. And why blame only hurts us is because if we don't take full responsibility for the part that we played in this, because truly, everybody's just walking around doing the best that they can with the tools that they have. Nobody's out to get you. If the people that helped, that sort of created this in us, knew better or had the tools to do better, they would have done better. They would have done better, but they didn't, and nobody can be blamed for that. And the other part of it is that when you blame, you leave yourself the victim. Because versus if you take full responsibility for the part you played in it, then that means that, and you say, I created it, then guess what? If you created it, you then have the power to uncreate it and recreate it in however you decide. But if you blame and it's all because of them, then you are forever the victim and you don't have the power to recreate it in the way of how you want to continue in your life.
Yeah, that's why, you know, explaining how you came to relate to yourself and others and food is so much more powerful than blaming. Blaming never helps anyone, but I mean, there are certain things that their blame is warranted, like abuse, but that's not what we're talking about with this. So yes, I mean, I thought you did a nice job of really looking at and explaining how the past, what you put it, how that then rises up and affects us in our present day, which of course is all about really in line with my analytic philosophy. Of course, what happens to us affects our present and therefore our future. So not placing blame. Yes. And I just, to your point, Christina, on Instagram, there are, as I just mentioned, with child abuse or any abuse of that nature, blame is warranted, but that was not the situation with Naomi's story. Absolutely.
I'm so sorry to interrupt. I do just want to, for Christina, you said, or Christine? Mm-hmm. I just want to say one thing. When there is abuse, and unfortunately we can't take that back, and the people that dished that out, I don't even know what to say about that. But I'm talking about the messages that we tell ourselves about ourselves, of why we were abused. And it had nothing to do with us. We were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And unfortunately, when you are in a life with somebody who can do that to you, you become collateral damage. But it had nothing to do with you as a person, your worth, and therefore have not the blame, but the strength to know that that had nothing to do with you. And if you are still living and you are still on this earth and you had the strength to get through that, then you have the strength to change your mindset and your view about yourself, about how strong you are, and that you can now recreate your life to be anything that you want it to be.
Yeah, that's a very empowering message. And yeah, and that's an important one, because the problem is kids are egocentric, and whatever something happens to them, they think it's their fault. And so then they blame themselves rather than look at it in a different way and being able to, as you said, retell the narrative, reinterpret what happened is very important and very powerful. So let's go back to your story and your story of what I like to call liberation, because as you know, I do not believe in recovery. I believe in liberation, absolutely putting binge eating or any kind of eating disorder behind us. Tell us what's going on with you now. How are you on your road to liberation?
So first of all, I love that you call it liberation, because that so much better fits what this is versus the word recovery. So yes. Well, I used to think that once you got to that stage, it was like magic, poof, and then pixie dust would come down and everything would just be perfect. It is really nothing of the sort. I have gone through many stages on my journey, and I'm definitely still on this journey, because there are a lot of stages to go through. I remember my very first stage, I was doing a podcast with somebody, and she had a cooking show. And I was backstage while she was finishing up with another guest, and they were talking about food. And she had just done a cooking demonstration. So I was sitting next to all of this food, and I was like smelling food. And then she was talking about food. So I'm listening to food, I'm smelling the food. And then she had her cookbook out. And so I'm looking at all these pages of food, and I was just surrounded by food. And all of a sudden, I just wanted to taste everything, because when you are a binge eater, you know, usually what you're doing is you're binging or you're restricting. And so when you've done that for so many years, you don't really taste food. And all of a sudden I wanted to taste everything. And I remember I said, you know, I really want to buy your cookbook. And she was like, oh no, you don't have to buy it. And I was like, no, I want to buy the cookbook. And I ran home, and for 3 months, every night I made gourmet meals. Not that I binged on them or like I even finished what was on my plate. I just wanted to taste everything. I just wanted to taste food. And it was so delicious. And I got to enjoy food without feeling guilty or without putting it on a scale or in measuring spoons. And I just ate until I was satiated. And it was like the most beautiful experience. So first I actually tasted and enjoyed food. Yay. That was so much fun. That was a great stage. And then what I'm realizing now, you know, without going through everything, what I'm realizing now is that there is no pixie dust and there is no magic potion. Really, what liberation from food is, and you see these people who are doing great with food and people who even never had issues with food. And what they're really doing is they're just waking up in the morning and they're just making a better choice. And they're deciding that they're worthy, and they are deciding what they want to put in their bodies and how they want to feel it and how they want to prepare it and how and what they want out of their nutrition for the day and how they want to nurture themselves. And it's just about changing the mindset, which will change the choices. And that is a lot of work that's being aware. and making those better choices and seeing yourself as deserving that.
Absolutely. It is all about your relationship with yourself. First of all, I just want to say about the cookbook and the gourmet meals, like, of course, because deprivation leads to wanting more. And that goes for binging, but it also goes for realizing that you were deprived of 40 years, you were deprived of enjoying food, because binging is not an enjoyable experience when it is just permeated with guilt and shame and obsessive and compulsive behavior. It's not enjoyable. And so to be able to, like, as you said, enjoy food and as it should be, food is one of the pleasures of life, and we should be able to enjoy it. I don't believe in clean eating and eating just to live. No, we're supposed to enjoy food. We're supposed to like it. So that giving yourself that was really nurturing to your palate, and I'm sure to your soul and on some level. And changing our relationship to ourselves is everything. It's easy to make good food decisions when we are not using food in some way to cope, to distract, to focus on that, so that we're not thinking about the issues and conflicts and problems in our lives. It's easier to focus on what we're eating than on what is eating at us. So
absolutely
beautiful that you're able to get to that point of liberation. And yeah, there's no pixie dust. I'm sorry, Oprah, with her aha moment, like, aha! And then everything falls into place. Not so much.
I actually learned, and I think I touched on this in the book, but I actually learned about aha moments, that there are those two kinds of aha moments where there are those aha moments where you realize it, but then it's a whole other step to actually implement that in your life and change your mindset so that you can change the habits. And just because you realize one thing one moment, it still takes so much effort to actually put that into practice. And there's so many layers underneath. So you may have an aha moment about, like, the surface stuff, but then to go underneath and dig all that up is a whole other step. And that's why shows like yours and all that you provide for this community, Dr. Nina, is so important, because just hearing, listening every day, being able to delve into the books at any time, being able to have these on podcasts, it's really keeping it in the forefront of your mind and constantly reminding yourself that is going to get you to where you want to go. It's like any other thing that you need to work on in your life.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be able to provide that idea that there are unconscious parts of us that are hidden from us for a reason, as a protection, and that discovering the hidden parts of us, the why we're turning to food, is much, much more important and essential to explore and examine and bring into the light than what we're eating. Yeah. And I think one of the most painful, difficult, excruciating parts of change is when what you know psychologically, what you know logically doesn't fit in with what you feel psychologically. Like, yes. That's the work. When you know something, but you can't quite feel in relationship to what you know. And the aha moment is the, oh, now I realize that. And now I know that. But then the work is syncing up, which your book describes, syncing up with, well, then how do you translate that into feeling differently and then doing things differently? Yeah. Okay, so in the book, you list 36 lessons that you learned throughout your life that assisted you in liberation. Can you share a few of them?
So I'm going to read to you from here, and I marked a few of them that I wanted to actually go over, if you happen to have asked. So the one that I want to read is number 25, try as you may, you can't make other people change or make them happy. It's not your job anyway, so you can just scratch that one off your list. There are some people that no matter how you try to please them, you can dedicate your life to it, but you'll never make them happy. You'll never be enough for them. You'll never do enough for them. There will be nothing that you can do to make them happy what you did by them. It's not going to happen. And it is not your job to do that, because your job is to make you happy. Your job is to know your own worth. Your job is to learn to just love every fabulous, incredible, beautiful thing about you and how special you are, and really know that. And that if somebody does not see your light, that's okay. That's them, and that's not you.
And that is such a hard lesson to learn, you know? And some people love to suffer. Some people don't want to be happy. You know? Some people don't see us as we are. They see us as if we're someone else. You know? And realizing that there are dynamics and things hidden. If you are staying in an intractably stubborn way in that mode of relating, it frees us from trying to get them to change. All we can change, to your point, is us. Exactly. I think that should be, which number was that? I think that should be number one. That's such an important lesson. What's number one?
Oh, what is number one? Let's go back. Number one is comparison is a killer. It will kill the real, authentic, original, unique you. Bury that bad boy before it buries you.
Yeah. Theodore Roosevelt said, comparison is the thief of joy, but I kind of like bury that bad boy before it buries you.
What I find with comparison, and this is, I always think about this whenever I think about comparing. So there you are, and you're doing your own unique, special way of doing whatever you're doing. But then you look like, I don't know, in your class or in your community or your group of friends or on social media, and you see someone else achieving what you want to achieve, but they're doing it in a totally different way, right? So then you're like, oh, maybe I should try what they're trying, but you're not them. So you can't do what they're doing because you're not them. So then let's say you guys are like this and they're just succeeding a little bit better than you, but then you try and be like them and then you're going to gear off because you can't be them. And then you just have to be you. Just stick to you and how you're doing it. Let them do it their way. Let them have their own journey and their own time. And you just be, just stop comparing yourself and just be you.
Who was it? Supposedly Marilyn Monroe said, be a first-class version of yourself instead of a second-class version of someone else.
Yeah. I never heard that one. That's awesome.
Or maybe it was Audrey Hepburn. She also said, nothing is impossible. After all, the first two letters spell I'm possible. Who knows? Whoever said it, you could take credit for it. Because it's the same thing we're saying, you know?
Yep.
Okay, so what are your, I'm looking at them too. I mean, I think all of them are fantastic. What are some of your other favorites?
I think that my most favorite one is the last one, which is, there is no food that exists in this world where binge eating it will ever make you feel better. And then I just write in parentheses, but just in case I'm wrong and you do find it, please let all of us know. Thanks, a girl could dream, right? But there is no food. I mean, honestly, have you ever had a binge and then felt better after? Like, never. Not one time. There is no food that exists in this world. And what I feel like happens is that you're searching prefer this food that's going to make you feel better, but then you can't find it. And that's why you keep going and you're switching from sweet to salty to crunchy, just like, you know, depending upon like what your go-tos are. Right. And then, but it never happens. And that's why I feel like a binge takes so long, because you're trying to find that one thing that's going to make you feel better, but it doesn't exist. So you just keep going and going until, well, then you just can't fit anything else in your body. And then you're just in a gluten fog or sugar coma, and then you're just done and you're sufficiently numbed. So you move on, but you're numbed, but you're not better. There's nothing that'll ever make you feel better, ever, ever. It doesn't exist.
Binging is actually a form of self-abandonment, even though it is disguised as a way to make you feel better at times. But ultimately, it's a way of abandoning yourself. But when you show up for yourself, when you are there for yourself, when you encourage yourself, and which is really what you write about, you know, and are your own best friend, then you are the thing that you're looking for in a binge. So
you're looking for you.
You're looking for you. Yeah.
To show up and stand up.
The loving, lovable you that is there. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to cry now.
Well, listen, you a beautiful and humorous, just as you know, hey, a girl can dream, right? Like sort of funny attitude you have towards yourself that really makes this you know, book so, it's so poignant and so painful and so readable and funny. It's like life, right? It's poignant, it's painful, and it's humorous. So you did a beautiful job. And again, the book is Binge and Sprint. Naomi, tell us where people can find the book and also where they can find you and what you're up to right now.
Okay. So first of all, my book is on Amazon. It's Binge and Sprint. And you can purchase it on Amazon. And I would love to hear from you. You can contact me through my website, which is bingeandsprint.com. And you can find me on Instagram at Binge and Sprint. And what's going on with me next is that I actually am in the editing mode of a workbook that is a complement to my book. And what we're going to be doing in the workbook is, I know that there are a lot of workbooks that exist that I have used, which have been tremendously helpful. With behaviors and changing your food behaviors. But my workbook is going to be a little bit different in that it is going to, we're going to go back, way back, back in time, and really go to the underlying reasons, how it got started, and how we can change our mindset going forward. So I'm really looking forward to that. That's going to be out later this year. And if you keep in touch with me, I'd be, you know, more than happy to give you the heads up on when it comes out. But we're in the editing process right now, so it's really exciting.
Well, that is very exciting. It is going to help a lot of people. And again, I am so glad that you were here to join me today and help our audience feel inspired. If you could do this after 40 years, anyone can do it, right? You were so entrenched in binging.
I truly believe, and you know, I don't know about me. I don't know if, like, you know, if I could do it, you could do it. But I do believe that anyone can overcome an eating disorder. I really believe it, and I believe in you. If you are listening, I really believe in you. And I know that you've the strength to do it. I don't believe that God gives any challenge to anybody that doesn't already have everything inside them to overcome it. If you sometimes just throw your hands up and say, maybe this is just the way I'm supposed to be or what I'm supposed to be doing, that's like the devil on your shoulder whispering in your ear. No, you don't. No, I don't believe that. Keep going. Keep finding the next thing. I did it for 40 years. Keep finding the next thing and pull yourself out. You can do it.
I still say that if you can do it and you were so entrenched and you provide in this book, take some acknowledgement, Naomi. if you, given what you went through, could find it within you to create that change, you're an example to other people. If you can do it, you're showing them tacitly through this book, they can do it too.
Thank you.
You are welcome.
I'll own it.
Okay. Yes. Own it. And thank you again for being here. And that is our show for today. Thank you all so much for joining me today here on the Dr. Nina Show. I am here every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific. Or you can listen later at Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get podcasts. If you love the show, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating or a review, because the more reviews and ratings we get, the more people we can reach and help. So stay curious, not critical. I will see you next week. Bye for now.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.